Welcome back to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I'm Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
I'm glad I remembered who I was, and you remembered who you were.
We're off to a good start.
It's a good start, batting 1,000. So, and there are some major league players who are batting 1,000. How do you like that?
Ian Happ is batting 1,000 after the first pitch.
Yes, he led off the season, the very first pitch of the season with a home run. Clayton Kershaw is batting 1,000. He's 2-for-2. Although he has a loss after 21 scoreless innings in spring when it really matters. He gave up a home run on the fifth to Joe Panik. The Dodgers lost 1-0. Nobody is pressing the panic button, but he's on pace for 162 home runs. So there's that. Big day for Matt Davidson with the White Sox. We'll talk about opening day in a little bit. I don't want to get ahead. We'll talk about the NCAA tournament because that's super fun, particularly right now, particularly if you're a Kansas fan like both of us are. And, one thing that came up last week, and it was interesting to see, you may have seen it on ESPN. Leonard Hamilton, the coach of Florida State, after the game, was approached by Dana Jacobson of CBS, inquiring what most of us would think is a reasonably simple question, and you and I have played together in the men's league enough to know how we would have reacted in the situation, but down 4 with 10 seconds to play, and Florida State, rather than fouling, just lets the clock go, and ball game is over in a 68-64 loss. Of course, Jacobson, being a member of the media, took it upon herself to ask the question that was being asked in the broadcast booth and asked Leonard Hamilton, hey, so down 4 with 10 seconds left, why didn't you foul? And, he gave her what I would consider to be a less than courteous answer.
That's a kind way of putting it.
Looked at her as if she had two heads for asking the question. Yeah. And was excoriated in the media the next day for doing that. And, of course, the questions that come up are, first of all, if you're Jacobson, can you ask a question like that? Is that appropriate to do at that point in time? And some people kind of push things a little bit further and say, if it were Coach K, would you have asked Coach K the question?
And of course, Dana, to her credit, says simply on her Twitter feed, yes, I would have. You know, she said, yes, she would have, talking in the third person. But any trained journalist, you know, member of the media, they're going to ask the key questions, especially in a tight time frame where you only have a minute or so on a broadcast post game. You can ask a couple questions, and one of them is usually, in that setting, tell us about the season, you know, how far you've come, what did you tell your kids after the tough loss. But it's also a question about the game itself,
right?
And the key question that anybody would want to know, you don't have to be a coaching expert to know that if you're down 4 with 10 seconds left in basketball, the game's not over because there's the three-point line.
Yeah.
And because people miss free throws. And because people miss free throws under pressure when the trip to the Final Four is on the line. So anybody who had the microphone would have asked that question. That's what they want to know. Coach, why didn't you foul at that juncture?
I think she handled herself perfectly. She didn't really back down. I think she was a little bit surprised by it. The thing that is probably most difficult for Leonard Hamilton is if you asked him before the game, hey, if you're down 4 with 10 seconds left, will your guys foul? And he would have said, yeah, we'll foul. That if you had had, not that you would have known exactly what the situation is, he would have said, oh yeah, we'll foul. I think the response that he made was, I'll call it embarrassment. But usually if somebody reacts in a certain way, particularly a way like that, it's because they're embarrassed by something. And in his case, have a feeling that he was probably embarrassed that he hadn't come to that conclusion or executed on that conclusion. Because you know how it is. You get to the end of a game and things just start happening fast. The guys who, people can say whatever they want about clutch, but the guys who can win in a situation like that are the guys who can either keep it at real time or slow it down when it gets faster. And that's, I'll say what you and I have discussed privately. The that comes through repetition. That does not come through a, all right, I'm here and this is a new situation for me and I haven't thought through it before. And even if you have thought through it before, there's no, not saying that you're going to do it. So the question of, would Coach K have faced the same line of questioning? Probably not, but that's because he would have been fouling.
Exactly.
Grayson Allen would have tripped somebody. We'll get to that later, too.
No, that's a great point. Coach K would have had his guys foul right away. And you want to give people, you know, the benefit of the doubt or the recognition that people make mistakes under pressure. So I'm all for that. We're not expecting people to be perfect. But this is just a very basic strategy. And, you know, you also want to, you know, give them an excuse of, well, maybe there was a miscommunication, a lack of communication. People weren't on the same page. But remember, this took place right in front of the Florida State bench.
Yeah.
So you had Coach Hamilton was standing up right next to the play. You had all the assistant coaches right there. You had all the players on the bench right there. So all it would have taken would have been one of them to yell foul right away.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. Things start to happen. I had fallen asleep at that point in the evening, but so I missed the end of it. The game was on, but I missed the end of it and turned on the TV the next morning and saw everything. But in that situation, particularly with Michigan shooting a 1-1, it's a really a golden opportunity for you. You and I referenced what happened with Kansas back in 2008 when Derrick Rose and the guy with the hyphen in his last name for Memphis.
Yeah, the wing player.
Yeah. Chris Douglas Roberts.
Yes.
There you go. When the two of them missed big free throws, ultimately resulting in Mario Chalmers' three. But it doesn't happen if Self is not having his guys foul at that point to basically keep them in the game and stop the clock. And where did we see it? It wasn't in the distant past. What game was that? Where the clock expired in a game because a team hadn't fouled earlier to put themselves in that situation to get the other team into the bonus. They just couldn't stop the clock fast enough.
Right, that was Nevada.
That's
against
right.
Loyola of Chicago.
That's right, yeah.
But, you know, you talk about recent examples. This just happened with the Celtics against Oklahoma City. They're down by 6 with 20 seconds to go, and they won the game.
Yeah.
And that was not because when they were down 4, they stopped fouling.
Right.
You know, Brad Stevens is a genius at late-game strategy. And so to think that the Celtics could do it against an NBA team and the guys that they put on the line in that game, Carmelo Anthony and Russell Westbrook.
Yeah.
And Russell Westbrook missed one of his free throws when it was a 4-point game. So he pushed it to 5. Celtics come down, hit a 3. Now it's at 2. Then they foul Carmelo. He misses both of his free throws.
Right.
So even the best players in the world, future NBA Hall of Famers.
Oh, yeah, both of them.
Will, from time to time, miss their free throws in this last-minute clutch situation. And if you come down and hit a couple threes, like the Celtics do, Marcus Morris hits the game winner, you can win the game easily in that scenario.
You could also give Hamilton the benefit of the doubt that he had instructed his players to foul and his players had not executed on it. That's also a possibility. And that he was doing the right thing as a coach and not throwing his players under the bus at that point in time. That certainly could be a possibility. I don't listen to sports talk radio, ironically, so I don't know if that's been explored.
You just create it.
I just create. That's all. But the Hamilton came out the next day, gave a very what appeared to be a nice heartfelt apology.
Except he didn't actually apologize to Dana Jacobson. He tried to defend himself, I think, too much. I don't think it was a legit apology. I mean, it was a statement. It was a couple paragraphs. He talked about the emotion of the game. He said he wish he would have handled it differently. But he didn't actually come clean and apologize directly to her, which is what I think he should have done. Because, like you said, he looked at her like she had two heads. He responded with anger to her question. And if it was as simple as, well, one of my players just sort of lost his train of thought in that clutch situation and didn't foul, and he didn't want to throw his player under the bus, that would have been one thing. But again, it happened right in front of him at the bench, and he was looking at the play, and he didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So I think he's got to own up to it, and instead of, you know, taking it to the extreme of acting like it was a terrible question and an inappropriate question, you know, he should have been a lot closer to the other extreme of, you know, own up to it. Oh, it was a mistake. You know, next time I would have done it differently, whatever the case may be.
The other question, I guess, as it pertains to that, would he have answered the question differently if it had been Jay Billis asking the question?
Exactly.
And would his behavior, and women in sports reporting roles have had it notoriously difficult over the years where, and you look at somebody like Doris Burke, who has been a pioneer in a lot of ways, who knows the game inside and out, but she has had to fight and grind to get every possible opportunity that she has. And now she's 52, 53 years old. She's getting the respect that she probably should have been getting years ago as somebody who is a knowledgeable basketball person, regardless of anything else, gender, you name it, as probably the best basketball color commentator who's not sitting in this room.
It's a small group.
I know, seriously, there are very few. But you like that. There are very few that are at that level that she is. And she's done a great job, but it has taken a long time for her to get to that level of respect. And you also wonder if Leonard Hamilton doesn't have it across his mind. Yeah, I know that I screwed up. Yeah, I know that I should have done it. And who are you to be asking me that question?
Right.
Like, I've paid my dues. And he's been a great coach. He's got a wonderful track record and a great career. I don't think anybody thought Florida State was going to get that far in the tournament. So kudos to them. You just never want to see the season end like that. So with that, you and I took a look at something that Ivy Leaguer Doug Glanville penned in the New York Times at the beginning of baseball season, talking about what it's like to be on a baseball team. You've played on a bunch of them with a number of different guys, different backgrounds. I think about our ridiculous softball team and how we pick on each other as far as really anything and everything. Nothing's off limits. But that's, in a lot of ways, that's how you come to form a bond, and that makes the bond stronger. And Glanville talks about how in society we want to put people into these nice little buckets, and those buckets don't always work for people.
Yeah, that's right. And there's nothing like a baseball clubhouse because of, you know, at the major league level, you've got so many different international players that come from a variety of backgrounds, and they speak different languages.
Yep.
And you're thrown into this locker room for as many as 11 or 12 hours a day, day after day. It's unique in that you play every day. It's the longest game. You know, it's an average of over 3 hours. But you don't just show up at 6:30 for a 7 o'clock baseball
no.
game. You show up around noon. You start to get loose. Maybe you lift weights. Maybe you take early batting practice. You have lunch. You take a shower. You hang out in the clubhouse, and then you get ready for pregame warmups, and then you play your 3 hour game, and then you wind down after the game in the clubhouse. So you're around each other so much
yep.
that it creates a very unique situation in sports that you don't have in any other sport. In basketball, if you play, you may play 3 or 4 games in a week, but it's a much shorter game, and you're not there for 11, 12 hours straight before and after the game.
Right. It can represent a lot of challenges, particularly even in our country, there are a lot of different types of people and people with different beliefs. And it's easy, at Glanville's point, it's easy to look at it and say, hey, Curt Schilling might have diametrically different political views than I am, and I don't want him on my team. And Glanville's point is, hey, you know what? If I had a game 7, there's nobody else I'd want on the mound other than that guy. He's a little bit old now. I don't know that I would want him today, but he was a proven winner in the major leagues, and you put that aside. He throws in the examples of Sean Dunstan, who was a number one draft pick overall, and African-American player, and Mark Grace, who's a Tustin High grad. I believe, a Southern California kid. And the two of them would have all kinds of debates about things, but had respect enough for each other that over the course of a season, they're having good arguments and good conversations and hopefully getting more knowledgeable about each other. And then that takes us to a guy that you and I actually disagree on, oddly enough, Greg Popovich, who seemingly year after year pulls together these teams that it's almost like the United Colors of Benetton, where he's putting together all kinds of Patty Millses and Ginobili's and Tony Parker's and Tim Duncan's and putting together great teams of guys who, in a lot of cases, don't even speak the same native language.
Right. And the common denominator there that I see is in the baseball setting, you've got all these different guys, and what pulls them together is their competitive spirit and their approach to the game. So if you have that consistency throughout your clubhouse and you're all pulling together on the field towards a championship, then the different personality features, you can overcome them, you can respect them. And Coach Popovich obviously has done a tremendous job with that same thing in the NBA with the Spurs. He's taking these guys from all over the world and he's got them to, you know, adhere to the Spurs way of, well, we're going to win 50 games every year. We're going to play above our talent potential that most people would describe. You know, we're going to rise to the occasion and be better as a group than we would be individually, taking all of these individual personalities and backgrounds into account. So I'm going to give him a lot of credit for that.
Yep.
But when you keep in mind this media conversation we're having.
Yes.
And you mentioned Doris Burke. What I don't look up to Coach Popovich for is how he how he treats the sideline interviewers during the NBA game. And I think I've heard Doris Burke even say that she does not want to do those interviews, even though she should have all the respect in the world to go out and ask her two questions, because you only get two during the NBA telecast. She doesn't even want to do it because he makes all of the sideline reporters feel terrible for just doing their job.
Yeah, it's sideline is not easy. It's not even close, because there are some times that you set yourself up and you think, okay, I'm in the right place for my post-game interview, and oh my God, that was just a pick six and the game's over and I'm not going to get my interview. Or I ask a question that's a well-thought-out question and I get an answer like Dana Jacobson got. It just happens. It's not an easy thing.
But with Coach Popovich, it happens every time.
It happens every time. The only thing I'm going to say that's my bailout for Popovich, there are two. One, he was an assistant in Kansas under Larry Brown.
I know. That gives him an extra like 25% in my book, too. That saves him as well. What was your second?
Pomona Pitzer.
Okay.
He did coach at the tiny Pomona College.
Right.
And my number one bailout for Popovich is how he acted when Craig Sager came back. And I got the feeling that, yeah, maybe he respects these guys as they're doing their jobs. He just doesn't want to play along with the circus. And it's more the fact that somebody's telling him he has to and he doesn't really want to. But when Sager came back from fighting cancer and was doing the sideline and Popovich gave a heartfelt welcome back to him, and you can tell that it meant a lot to Sager and you can tell that it meant a lot to Popovich, to me that made him... that humanized the whole thing and almost made it. And I realized Doris Burke is somebody that I have tremendous respect for. It made it so that I said, okay, maybe this whole thing's your shtick. I don't know that it is, but Popovich was looking at it like, hey, these people are real people and they're doing their jobs too. So
I of course agree with you. I like the fact that he treated Craig like that. But it just shows to me that he is aware of what's going on. He has the capacity to show that human side, and you know it's in him, and he completely shuts it off with almost everybody else.
Yeah, sometimes it's just really hard to be civil to people.
Yeah,
yeah. Sometimes you just have to fight the sarcasm, and sometimes the sarcasm wins. So take a quick break. Come right back. We'll have Bedford High girls softball coach. I guess there's only one softball team in Bedford, so I don't even have to specify girls. Jay Brewster right after this. Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. here with Bedford softball coach Jay Brewster. And, of course, going into year two, last season ended one win away from the championship. How tough is that for you going into the season?
I really don't think it's that tough at all, to be honest with you. We knew going into last season, we started off 7-0. So we knew we had to continue to play well, but we ended the season 9-7. So in ending the season 9-7, going into the playoffs, we had to get hot, and we did. We had a great game against Concord, won that game on their field, played Londonderry, who was in first place. We beat them. Then went to the SNHU, which is the first time the school had ever gone to the semifinals before. So the girls were all excited about that. We beat Spalding. And then we lost a heartbreaker. It was tough, but at the same time, it just makes us stronger. So going into this season, we know we can do it. We know that we can get hot toward the end of the season when the games really, really count. Not that they don't count now, but we know that if we stay together and stick together and play as a team, we should be fine.
Well, you went into the season, you said, starting 7-0 and then wound up as a ninth seed in the playoffs and kind of rode that wave. And we saw it during basketball season. Dover beat our boys team and wound up in the finals. And that can happen, particularly when you don't have a ton of teams in the tournament. So for those who don't know the program, who are some of the stars or names to look out for heading into the season?
I don't think we really have any stars. I think what we have is a well-rounded team. And we've got some players that are can do a lot of different things for us, which is kind of what you need in a softball program, multiple position players. So we have our seniors. We have Erin Murphy, who played third for us last year, was switching her over to second base, got a great bat. We have Maddie Owenses, who is kind of one of those players where she's going to get some playing time, but when she goes in, she gives 100%. So she's going to be one of the players that we use in the outfield and maybe occasionally over at first base. We've got three players that are kind of like on the injured reserve list right now, if there was such a thing. It's Kylie Diamond, who's one of our captains. She was our catcher last year. She can no longer catch, so we were going to work her into first base, but she's got some concussion problems, so she's going through protocol right now. So when we get her back, we'll work her into the first base position. Caitlin Fletcher, who was a standout outfielder for us last year, both in left field and in right, she's also on concussion protocol right now, so she's going to be starting the year probably on the bench until she gets her legs back under her and her timing. But she's a good outfielder, probably right side infield. We can maybe put her at first, maybe put her at second base, but she hasn't practiced there at all. The third person on injured reserve is Maddie Freitzel, who's our starting pitcher. Maddie's only a junior, but pitched for us last year. We lost Katie Martin, who was a graduating senior last year. We lost her half the season last year, and Maddie stepped in and did a great job for us. So we have all the confidence in the world as far as her coming back this year and being a real good pitcher for us. But again, she's comes back April 4th is her clear date, so she's not going to have a whole lot of preseason time, but we'll get her in as soon as we can. In the meantime, what we'll use is a couple of sophomores, Caroline O'Donnell, who's a lefty, and we'll use Alexis Diamond, Carly's sister, also a sophomore. We'll use her. Used them the other day in a scrimmage, and they did great. So have a lot of confidence in our pitching. Juniors, we've got Maddie Lucatoni, who can basically play any position. We'll use her to start the year behind the plate. She's very versatile. Not only does she play softball, but she plays girls ice hockey. She was a captain of the ice hockey team, and she was also on the football team this year, and has been for the last few years. So she'll do some catching for us. She'll play outfield, maybe occasionally over at first base. Whitney Fitzgerald is also a junior. She'll play first base for us, and she'll spell Maddie behind the plate. Erica Barley, who is probably one of the if we had any stars, she's definitely one that you'd put toward the top of the list. Great bat, plays shortstop, can catch, can play just about any position. If we had to use her at pitcher, we probably could. Then we go down to our sophomore class. We've got Amelia Edwards, who will use left side of the outfield, so she play left or center. We'd probably put her at shortstop if we needed an infielder. We have Catherine Sasso, who can play second base and also play outfield. We actually had her throwing a little bit today as pitcher. We could use her in an emergency situation. And then we have Morgan Freitzel at third base. Morgan is unbelievable. She's got a great bat. She'll probably bat fourth for us this year. She can hit a ton, and she's one of the best third basemen I've ever seen, and I've been coaching a long time. One of the juniors I forgot to mention is, one of the seniors I forgot to mention is Aaron Bowden. Aaron will come out and play outfield for us. She'll probably start the year in center field. I can see her moving over to either right or left, depending upon what we're facing for a lineup. So, good group of girls.
Coach, you mentioned the scrimmage you had this Wednesday in the Dome. How many more opportunities do you have for scrimmages before the season opener?
Well, we've got a few scheduled. Tomorrow we're playing Goffstown here on the football turf. That starts 9 o'clock. We'll do our regular warm-up. It's a great thing to do, a scrimmage where it's more or less timed, but our first hour is what we'll usually do when we get to a field. Warm up our pitches, take some batting practice, take some infield, shag some fly balls. So we'll do that for the first hour, and then we'll scrimmage them from 10 to noontime. We have a scrimmage scheduled for next Tuesday against White Mountains over at Slavoski. Probably not going to happen. Thursday, we have another scrimmage scheduled for against Bishop Brady, a good Division III team. White Mountains is a perennial winner at Division IV. But that game probably won't happen either because the field just doesn't look like it's going to be ready. And then next weekend we're supposed to play down in Windham at the softball festival. That usually doesn't happen because you can almost forecast rain for that day. But we've got the turf scheduled for 9 to 11 next week, next Saturday. So we'll if we can't get down to Windham because of their playing the field conditions, we'll have them come up here.
It's funny how that works. There are some events up here that you can just guarantee, like the Deerfield Fair. You can guarantee that weekend it's going to rain.
Yeah, it always rains on the Windham Softball Festival.
So, of course, we're here with Bedford girls softball coach Jay Brewster, and we've seen a lot of the girls this offseason. You mentioned Maddie, who's been busy with a variety of things, but the core of the team has been working pretty hard to grow Bedford softball. Tell us a little bit more about what they've done in the community so far.
Sure. Beginning of this year, we started our winter workouts like in the December, late December, middle December, early January time frame. We had the girls come to the gym. They would be there from 8 to 10 o'clock. We used St. Elizabeth Seton Activity Center. Father Quinn's been a great support for us over the years, for all youth sports, actually. But we're able to go in there with the girls and do some hitting in a cage. We also do some fielding, and we thought it'd be a good idea to open that up to Lurgio. So Lurgio would come in, Chris LeMay and his girls would come in. He was getting 15, 16 girls a week, which was great. And then after Lurgio, the Bedford girls high school team, the varsity girls, would come back, and we would run a clinic for grades 3 through 6. So we're basically started word of mouth. A few girls showed up the first week. By the last week there, we have like 20 names on the list. What we're hoping is that we can get an intramural team going over at McKelvey. Hopefully, I know that the principal over there, Mike Fournier, has a real interest in doing that. It's just a matter of getting volunteers to run the program. He'll do all the advertising and stuff. The other purpose of that is to encourage these girls to play in the BGSL, which is our rec league here in town. Steve Grocott, over the years, has done a great job promoting that, and we need players at every level. This is the first year that I can remember that every Division I high school has a JV team. Typically, there's not enough girls to do that, but this year it's happened, which is good. Division II and some of the smaller schools just can't field those teams. We came close here in Bedford. We have 23 kids on the entire roster. So we're doing swing players that enable us to field both teams. So we've got the three girls, our two pitchers that I already mentioned, and Elise Buchanan, who's swinging between both teams depending upon injuries and depending upon numbers. So getting the numbers up, starting at the grassroots with the younger kids is very important because it's nice to have 26, 27 kids coming out for a softball team. It makes your JV program more consistent.
Absolutely. And one thing that we've seen that's been a little bit different, regardless of the coaches that we speak to, are a lot of these kids are playing travel ball. So ultimately, that there's a positive and a negative. You're losing out on some of the development opportunities in town, but oftentimes they're getting more opportunities and access to indoor coaching as well.
Yeah, luckily, I mean, the rec league has suffered over the years. BGSL has suffered at the all-star level. As far as the rec level goes, it's just because of a matter of interest. The kids have so much going on. They have, you know, year-round soccer. They play in lacrosse. Basketball has AAU programs. So it's all this stuff that's going on, and it's kind of at the rec league level, softball can be kind of boring. I mean, especially for little kids, you know, they don't know that on a ground ball to second base, nine players move. They don't know that.
Right.
Typically, the second baseman is active and everybody else is watching. But what we need to do is we need to get kids into that rec league. We need to develop them there. And then when they go on to travel, even though they might not be playing in the town league, they're getting better and better because they're just playing so much. They're playing year-round. When they get to the high school level, they're back to their town. It's the first time. We've kind of gone full cycle, right? We start in the rec league. They're representing Bedford. Then when they get to Lurgio and they get to high school, they're representing their town. So one of the things that we do at the high school level is we say when you enter the doors for practice, because it's always inside to start the year, or you come to the field at Slavoski when we're doing practice, there's no travel gear. Everybody wears a Bedford High School gear. The colors are red, black, they're silver, they're white. They're not, you know, whatever travel team colors that they play for. The logo on their helmet is a bulldog. It's not any of the other travel teams that are out there. And that's not a knock on the travel teams, just so kind of a way of unifying all those travel girls to be representative of their town. And so when we get on the bus, even though it sometimes says Goffstown on the side, it's the trucking center, it's a Bedford, is Bedford kids inside there, and we get off representing Bedford.
Awesome. Well, as you head into the season, we wish you all the best. Thank you for the time. We'll have you on in a few weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks.
That was Coach Jay Brewster, the head coach of the Bedford softball team. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox alongside Andrew Hansen. And you and I were kind of excited about that late game on Sunday, the Duke-Kansas game.
Oh, just a little bit.
Yeah. My wife, who is the Kansas alum, refused to be in the room with the game on for fear that she would somehow spoil things. When I was away from the game, oddly enough, the things turned in Duke's favor. So I was allowed a pass away from the kitchen table and was allowed to plant myself in front of the TV, but I couldn't sit. I could only stand.
I also could not leave the room. It was a mixture of sitting and standing and some loud words directed at the TV, some positive, some negative. My family had to leave the room for a little bit. Get their own break, sort of early second half, and Sarah kept checking in, okay, what's the score, how are we doing? And so they came down for the last 2.5-3 minute push.
Yep.
And boy, was the room a lot happier when we went to overtime, and then with how that turned out.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's sometimes when you go to overtime and it feels like we have to go to overtime and the team's depleted. And then there's sometimes you go to overtime and it feels like going to overtime is a win.
Right. Like, this is ours.
Yeah. I mean, this was one of those times.
We have all the momentum and there's no stopping us.
Yeah.
But so many clutch, memorable plays down the stretch, starting with that last minute. So let's start with Svi with the big three.
Oh, and me yelling in my living room. You probably heard me. Svi, that was the other thing. I was giving play-by-play updates to everybody in the dining room.
Right. Just and passing along the information.
Yelling, Svi for three. Yeah. It's awesome.
With glee.
Yeah. Anyway, poetry.
Svi looks off Carter, evening the Elite Eight with Chalmers-like three. Shot for Final Four, trips the rim alarm five times. Banks closed for Allen. Opening up lead, Graham Vic Newman zone beater worth three from corner. Closing at the line, Newman's 13th OT point is KU's 13th. Vic launches ball up alongside Self's arms and fists. Coach K starts his walk.
Coach K didn't look happy.
No, he didn't have a very enjoyable walk to shake hands with Coach Self.
And it was funny. The conversation after the game was that the refs took the game away from Duke, but if you would watch the game in the first half, it really seemed like the refs were taking the game away from Kansas.
Yeah, I didn't get that sense of some big issue with the refs.
No.
There was that big call. The charge call where Carter got his fifth. I thought he moved laterally.
He did.
Right before contact, which would have been difficult for the referee to see because the referee was to the left side of Carter's body and he was moving left. But I think the replay supports the blocking foul call.
I agree with you. It was a small move, but it was a move nevertheless. And, hey, we saw the same thing happen in the Bedford girls game against BG when Allie Morgan was called for the block and the foul. And who was it? Evans for BG made the two and then the and one. And really, that was the difference in that game, was that play for all intents and purposes, the swing. But Kansas picked up the win in that one. A lot of fun to watch. And the other question to go along, not to dismiss any of the Malik Newman, 13 points in overtime, 32 overall for the game, was, and I called him Malik Allen because I was thinking ahead to the next guy, Grayson Allen, who it is an interesting piece. You brought it to my attention. I hadn't heard it, but I agree with it completely.
Yeah, so what happened was, and of course for the backstory, Grayson Allen has a history of tripping his opponents.
Tripping, elbowing, it's
upending with his hip.
Yeah, just search for Grayson Allen on YouTube, and people have put together a 5-minute video, which includes him sticking out his hip to get guys, going after a loose ball, but going slightly past the ball so he can clock somebody in the face. A number of trips that are completely unwarranted, elbows to the face driving, which, hey, that I understand, that's part of the game. There are time after time where, okay, if it happens once and the guy's contrite about it, you can say this is an isolated incident and he's learned from it. But
it's happened repeatedly. They've been uniquely flagrant fouls. He's had to miss time on the court because of it. You know, it's been in the media for a long time. You know, his quote unquote transformation or trying to get through it, get past it. But it is part of his past. There's no debating it.
Yeah.
The videos don't lie.
The other thing that I struggle with is when they stripped him of his captaincy and said, we're suspending him indefinitely, which turned out to be one game.
Right.
Like, that's, to me, that's the, okay, the newspaper prints a story that's completely factually inaccurate, and the story's front and center in massive type, and then prints the retraction in tiny agate type. That's not fair.
Right.
And so for Coach K to do that, and then the soundbite becomes he's suspended indefinitely, which sounds like a really long time. One game. Not working for me.
So with that as the backdrop, Grayson Allen, of course, was the guy who had that shot for the Final Four that miraculously did not go in because it hit the rim five times and the backboard twice.
Mm-hmm.
And it, somehow it did not fall through.
Game it was goes, the basketball gods.
Yeah, game goes to overtime. Kansas wins. So after the game, a national commentator named Nick Wright said, quote, "I had Duke in my bracket. I bet on Duke to win. But when that shot went up from Grayson, I was rooting for him to miss." So here we have a national commentator saying that he's rooting for a college player to miss.
Yep.
And anybody who knows that backdrop about Grayson Allen understands why, because this is not your typical college player who, you know, is striving to be his best and just happens to miss a clutch shot and you feel bad for him. This is the person who has that checkered past of weird, unacceptable conduct on the court. And that is, of course, why Nick Wright said, "I was hoping he would miss."
If I was coaching a preteen player on a basketball team and they did what Grayson Allen did, I would have benched them and reprimanded them. I'm not their parent, but from a coaching standpoint, hey, that's not fair. That's not the appropriate thing to do. That's not what you do. That's not the right way to play the game, not to throw that out there. And if it were a repeated pattern, even coaching preteens, I would have a conversation with parents. Hey, just so you know, if you didn't see it in the game, little Johnny did X, Y, and Z, and you don't see it. You don't see it at that level. I've been coaching kids for a long time, whether it's soccer, basketball, baseball, softball, you name it. And I cannot think of a single instance where I've had a kid that I have coached, and on other teams as well, do something that I would consider to be a dirty play. It just doesn't happen. It's not basic nature. It's not being competitive. There's a difference between being competitive and being dirty. And to Nick Wright's point, to kind of continue the rest of his thought, Grayson Allen was about to get a completely free pass. Here's a redemption story. And we love redemption stories. Tim Tebow is still playing in the minor leagues. Tiger's in the Masters in a week and a half, and look at him. This is a guy who is in a pit that he created. Nobody else created it. It's a consistent problem. And if it's a problem that you can cause, fix it.
Right. And so Nick Wright had that perspective, and he took a lot of backlash in the media for
ridiculous
rooting against Grayson Allen. You know, highly respected college basketball analyst and commentator Fran Fraschilla said on Twitter exactly why these shows are worthless, talking about what Nick Wright was saying on his show. And Nick Wright responds, "God forbid I be honest about my thoughts regarding Grayson Allen and his collegiate career. Sorry if I offended your sensibilities, Fran." So I think I know the answer to this, but are you okay with Nick Wright as a national member of the media, you know, having this thought about Grayson Allen's shot and then sharing it with the world?
Yes, I'm okay with that. It's, you're playing at Duke. It's not, he's a basketball player who is in the media by virtue of the fact that the NCAA is a multi-billion-dollar institution. Yes, he is a kid, but I would expect that a kid of character would have made better decisions along the way and would still continue to make better decisions. I would hope that he has learned at this point. Never would I think that he has, because I think given the opportunity, he'd stick out his leg and trip somebody else again.
Yeah, he just did it in the ACC tournament against North Carolina.
He did it with his hip against North Carolina.
He got a flagrant foul for it.
And
he's a senior.
Right.
So we're not talking about an 18-year-old freshman who we're attacking. We're talking about a senior at Duke who's been with Coach K for 4 years. He's had plenty of time to get past this and overcome it.
For anybody to hitch their wagons to this guy and say this wasn't appropriate, to me, that's a failing. And I think this is, I'm not going to say it's a blemish on Coach K's career, but I think when you talk about we are putting basketball players out there, and we're putting athletes out there who are going to make an impact in the world, and we're helping them improve and become better people by giving him a one game suspension when you really could have sent a message and taken care of this. You did yourself a disservice and you did your program a disservice, and you really kind of showed everybody what you're about, which is winning at all costs.
And it's too bad, because there's so many other Duke graduates who have
absolutely
been the utmost professionals, been great for the game. Grant Hill.
Oh, God, yeah.
Jay Williams, Kyrie Irving.
I would. And you look back at the 30 for 30, the Christian Laettner thing, that people couldn't stand Christian Laettner. Well, yeah, Laettner may have had his moments, but that, to me, that pales in comparison to the Grayson Allen era.
And that's saying a lot, because Laettner had his moments.
Laettner certainly had his moments, but he had good moments too.
Yeah.
He had 10 for 10 in that game against Kentucky in that regional final. So we alluded to it a little bit earlier. You had your space that you were occupying. I was standing. Jenny was not in the room. Superstitions in sports, I think we all have them. I worked at one point for the king of superstition, a gentleman by the name of Dirty Al Gallagher. And Dirty Al, you don't come by that nickname without really doing something to earn it.
Right. I mean, that's my question. How did he earn that?
When he was playing at Santa Clara in the 60s, he had a 25-game hitting streak. They had a 25-game win streak. And he did not wash his uniform. And I don't know that he showered. I hope the latter's not true, but I can't remember at this point. Dirty Al went through a really long period of time where his uniform wasn't washed because the team was winning and because he was hitting.
In baseball, that just happens, and you have to go with it. It's just part of the game.
But he was also, he was not a clean human being. Like, he would call me down to the clubhouse and say, hey, I need you to help me out downloading some stats on player X who's coming here for a workout, and I'd have to navigate on his keyboard between coffee and dip spit. it was gross. There are some people that superstition becomes a part of a lifestyle. Wade Boggs liked chicken.
He sure did.
A lot.
On quite a regular basis.
Yeah.
Like every day during the season.
Yep. Every day during the season. And he also had something with sevens where he liked to take batting practice or... what was it? It was 717 or 707. And at one point they were, I don't remember who they were playing, and that escapes me. Somebody set it up so that the clock would skip 707 and go from 706 to 708 to get Wade Boggs off of his routine.
That's important for him. And he would even go to the top step of the dugout at a seven, and he would time different things throughout the day leading up to the game, not just batting practice, but even going onto the field. And it sure worked for him. I mean, you don't hit, 330 year in, year out without a routine that works for you. And different players have a different level of superstition. He was one of the utmost proponents and, users of superstitions. But you see it a little bit more in baseball because it's a game that's every day. But I know it certainly helped me. And as I think about it as a general concept, I think it can be very important in multiple ways. Like, if you have a superstition with practice, then it helps you physically prepare for the game.
Yep.
If you have a superstition with stretching and warming up, it helps you physically get ready for the game. It helps you actually avoid injury.
Yep.
And then also mentally, just knowing you have done those things, it can help you perform better because you feel comfortable of, I'm physically ready to play in terms of my practicing my routine. I'm physically ready to play in terms of I'm not going to get injured today because I'm loose and I'm ready. And then you then take your superstitions to the next level with, you talk about your friend who wouldn't wash his uniform for 25 days because he was on a hitting streak. And what you do with superstitions is you pick out the things that work and you stick with them. And I think it really helps with positive imagery, that whatever it is, either it's I'm gonna warm up this way, I'm gonna practice this way to try and get myself to peak performance, And it could actually help you get to peak performance because mentally you are expecting, well, I just did this to get ready. Yesterday, I went 3 for 4 because I did this.
Yep.
And today I'm going to do the same thing because I'm going to prepare and expect to have that great outcome. So I think superstitions can be very valuable in terms of helping you get to your peak performance.
Right. There's also something that sports psychologists will describe as centering, where, hey, something happens on the field, good, bad, or indifferent. Don't get too high, too low, or the field or the court. And pick something out that is at every field. So they'll tell you, use a flagpole and use the flagpole. Focus on that for a second. Breathe. Okay, the whatever just happened, good or bad, is gone. And now I'm on to the next thing. The superstition is a form of centering. It gets you away from worrying about the task at hand. And now you're in some ways distracted by something else, which it's not a bad thing. With golf, I think golfers tend to be a very superstitious lot, obviously. The ones that you can see in the NBA, I think about Karl Malone had his free throw superstition where he would talk to himself on the free throw line. There were, I remember this was back in the 90s, the Lakers and the Jazz had a big rivalry in the Western Conference, and they would have people who were hearing impaired who could lip read attempt to read Karl Malone's lips and figure out what he was saying. I don't know what the benefit would have been of that, but.
Well, he became a much better free throw shooter.
He started out
very poorly.
Yeah.
And he's a great testament to all those big NBA players who are muscle bound. I mean, Karl Malone was a massive, massive physical specimen, and he made leaps and bounds improvements with his free throw shooting. And I would like to think that it was in large part because of that superstition. And you see it, you do see it visually with the free throw routine. Most players pick one and stick with it. The guys who are struggling, they experiment with things. You know, LeBron James has had 6 or 7 different free throw routines over the last few years as he tries to improve. Really, one of the weakest parts of his game has been his free throw shooting.
It's interesting to see. It's a lot of fun trying to pick up on what people are doing. Sometimes guys are more particular about it. I think Cal Ripken had his where he didn't like to touch any of the steps in the dugout on the way to the field. So he would leap from the dugout floor onto the field, which when you're 6'4" and ain't athletic, I guess you can do that stuff.
Risky, though, when you're trying to keep intact a 2,000-game-plus
right.
consecutive games played streak.
Yes. Crazy.
You mentioned golf. Jason Day is one of the golfers who you can see the superstition in most visibly because he will always get behind the ball and kind of close his eyes and visualize the shot. And what's fascinating about that routine is I think it's a combination of superstition with mental imagery. So he does it as a superstition to get ready mentally for each shot, but it's actually also helping him perform because he's visualizing the shot that he's going to go hit and he's expecting to do it. And then he goes ahead and addresses the ball and usually gets the outcome that he wants.
Right. I think visualization and superstition are a little bit different. Superstition to me tends to be, and I can't believe I had it in my notes and hadn't mentioned it. To me, I think of a guy like Nomar, who's popping out of the batter's box between every pitch and fixing his batting gloves like he's getting paid to do that instead of actually hit the ball.
Right.
There are some guys that...
If he were paid a nickel for every time he adjusted his batting gloves...
Oh, my God.
He would have been the highest paid player ever.
Yeah, that stuff was insane. And that is more along the lines what I'm thinking. Like, visualization with golf is critical. And if there's a hazard there, okay, the hazard isn't there. I'm just trying to hit my shot. That's kind of more what you're going after. And the superstition is more along the lines of I'm going to eat the same thing, drink the same thing, do this, not do that, drive in the car the same way. You have to be sitting there, standing here. I'm going to control what I can control and in hopes that I can control the uncontrollable.
No, I agree completely.
It was like Mickey Rivers right there.
I mean, what Nomar did is more of a pure superstition.
Yeah.
But that's what I think is so great about Jason Day, is he's combining the superstition with the visualization to actually improve his performance.
Right. So looking at the first day of the Major League Baseball season, just getting back to that real quick, good day yesterday for the Yankees.
Yeah, pretty hot start for their recent addition to the middle of the lineup, Giancarlo Stanton.
Not surprised there.
He destroyed that ball in his first at-bat. It just hit a BB to right center in Toronto for a round-tripper.
Yep. So it'd be interesting to watch him play at Yankee Stadium, too, which is more homer-friendly than whatever it's called, the Sky Dome, Rogers.
Yeah, right.
The Rogers Center. The other things that were kind of weird, Ian Happ, first pitch of the season, period, takes 1 yard. George Springer, for the second consecutive year, leads off the season with a home run for the Astros. And then the Astros, did you see their defense?
I did.
Four outfielders?
Yeah. Yeah, Bregman went to left.
Yes.
And sure enough, the fly ball went to left and he caught it.
Yeah. It's fascinating to see, and this will be a conversation for another week, but baseball changes. Year after year, there's something. Is it speed? Is it on-base percentage? Is it a true three-outcome hitter? Is it now it's launch angle? That's all anybody wants to talk about is the launch angle. Joey Gallo, who they kept running that shift on, hit three fly balls to the outfield, and that was that. Well, what's this year, what is going to be the thing, the undervalued thing? And we have been hinting at the fact that we might have Bill James on the show, still hoping to make that happen. That would be a good question to ask for him. Like, and chances are we don't even get a straight answer if we ask the question, because he may know and just may not be wanting to share. But one thing that we are certain that it will not be is the Red Sox bullpen performance from yesterday.
Well, that's right. I was going to say, you know, there has been more of a focus in recent years on bullpen performance and, you know, churn the ball over to the bullpen in the sixth or seventh inning. And the setup guys are becoming more and more valuable, higher and higher paid. But it sure didn't work for the Red Sox. So maybe that does show the importance of the bullpen, because Chris Sale was dominant.
Yep.
You know, just wowing us once again with these off-speed pitches that are 88 miles an hour. I mean, he's filthy as a lefty with that, with that delivery and the angle. But in comes Joe Kelly, who is consistent in that he always is going to hit 97 on the gun. But he's one of those guys that's either lights out or he can't get anybody out.
Right.
And unfortunately for the Red Sox, yesterday was an example of the latter.
It's one of those things. We saw it happen in the League Championship Series, and we saw it happen in the World Series as well. If you have a defined role for everybody in your bullpen, sometimes it works out well. And my case in point for that would be the Royals when they won it in 2015 and all the guys performed. So it was Herrera and it was Holland and it was Wade Davis and everybody had their role and they all did it. Everything was fine. When you have one guy in there who falls apart a little bit and you have to go to the closer earlier, or when the closer falls apart and leaves you with a tie game and you've depleted everybody in the bullpen up to that point, then what? And that's the thing that none of these guys have really been able to figure out yet, is what do we do when somebody doesn't do their job? So, and the Dodgers in the World Series last year, it was, okay, we really have nobody left to pitch at this point. Like, what next? So maybe that's the shift, or maybe the shift is a swing guy of some sort in the bullpen. Who do you run a six-man starting rotation with? That one guy that you can just say, okay, we're hosed. Hey, Ohtani, we need you in there for as many innings as we can get, because extra innings aren't going anywhere, at least maybe, unless they start with the man on second thing.
Right.
Eesh. All right. So with that said, we're done for another week of Fox on Sports. Like to thank everybody here at Bedford 105.1, Chris Gentry, of course, who's peeked in on us a couple times, Bill Jennings, Harry Kozlowski, Colleen Richardson for all their hard work. And anything else you want to say before we sign off?
Rock Chuck Jayhawk.
I was waiting for that. Catch you next time. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.